We're having a great conversation with Laura and Eric Roten about the Penn Turk UFO incident. It's a film put together by them, a documentary that you can find on the Paranormal Scholar, their website, along with a lot of other great content. I'm going to spend some time there myself. Saw the film mentioned on social media all over the place over the last 2 or 3 weeks. Since the documentary went up 3 weeks ago, it has 378,000 views, and it's excellent. We're having a good conversation. We'll open up the phone lines in a little bit. Some ground I want to cover first, but we'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. Laura and Eric, I'm thinking to myself how preposterous some of these explanations that you've received sound. I mean, there's the police agency saying, well, we have no records that any roads were closed in this time period. And by the way, all the officers who were involved in that are gone. It's ridiculous. And then the Ministry of Defense, you know, stonewalling any specific kinds of questions and saying, you know, we can't disclose it because our interests outweigh the public interest in this. It sure makes you seem like something really did happen. Are you both convinced that is what happened, that there was a UFO and it was chased by the military and maybe shot down? Because if that is what's true, it's disturbing at some level, isn't it?
Yeah, it definitely does seem as though something did happen. And of course, even the ludicrous responses that have been revealed via the Freedom of Information request were difficult to get. For example, you mentioned the police saying that all the officers who were involved on the night of the incident that they don't know about have conveniently gone now. It took some prodding to get that response. At first, the request was rejected on the grounds that it was vexatious, that it was irritating and was not necessary. So even those responses took some prodding. But as to whether or not we think something happened, it is difficult to argue otherwise. And there were other things that happened that night, such as a last-minute notice to airmen, which seemed to have shut down the entire airspace of Wales. The military said, nope, that airspace is ours tonight. Why would they need that? There's just too many questions.
And there was no commencement date or warning. It was really suddenly put up that notice.
There was another strange plane that was in the area at that time, exactly on the same day, the ZE-700 RAF. Eric, what's the deal on that plane?
Yes, is the ZE-700?
Yes.
That plane is usually reserved for officials, high officials in government or the royal family in the UK. Why was there right after this incident is kind of a mystery, alongside also why was the Prime Minister giving a speech around a couple miles away from where this incident happened, at an aviation plant of all places. I don't know. There's a lot of mysteries around that.
So the plane that would carry the royal family or high persons in government and the is there on that day, the Prime Minister happens to be giving a speech there that day. That's a pretty big coincidence. Kaz Clark, this witness, this key person in your film, Laura, you had mentioned earlier about her being threatened. In the film, you get a little more specific. She said that she'd been told, you don't want to have like a fatal car accident, do you? Something like that?
Yeah, that's what she claimed she was told. So the story is that in the immediate aftermath of her experience, she did quietly in circles on Facebook, for example, speak about her experience, and a few people had expressed interest and were in conversation with her. And on one occasion, somebody asked, I'd love to come out and see where this happened. Would you mind showing me? And she explains that she had agreed to do this with other people before, so it wasn't too unusual. So she agreed to meet this person, thankfully not by herself. And when they arrived, it was very much as though they weren't asking about an event that they did not know about. I think, Kaz, she told us it was something akin to they were remembering it, as if they themselves had also experienced it. And then, as you rightly say, they said something along the lines of, oh, well, you wouldn't want to be in a car accident, would you? And it wasn't just Kaz that they threatened, it was her family. And that was the real turning point for her.
Well, she's a brave woman, and it's outrageous that anyone would say that to her, whether they intended to carry it out or not. Eric, both you and Laura have mentioned Gary Jones and that there are other investigators chasing us. Have you had any assistance or have they had any assistance from sort of the international UFO community? Or is the story just now getting out to the world because of your film?
Sorry. I'll answer this one. So,
okay.
Yes. As you know, the UFO community is wonderful in its connectedness, and it is known about amongst other communities. But I think something about our film seems to have pushed it a little bit more into the mainstream, and whatever the reason for that is, you know, we can't be quite sure. But it's certainly not new to a lot of people in the UFO community. Paz, I'm sure, would speak a lot about how grateful she is for other people with expertise coming in and helping. But then equally on the other side, you do have people who do not believe, and there will always be that, unfortunately.
Right. Well, yeah, like that's... we put at the end of the documentary, we made a call out to get more witnesses. We need more. We need more to the story. You know, we do believe something happened that night, but all the details are not there. The government is definitely not helping. So, you know, more witnesses to this event would be really good for, to clarify what happened that night.
So the cover-up continues, but so does the investigation.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Have you had, I'm looking at your page, The Paranormal Scholar, and, you know, you, a lot of your work has been seen tens of thousands of times. This is by far the biggest, at least that I can see. You've had a tremendous response, right?
Yeah, it's certainly got a lot of views straight off the bat. We have had some of our work achieve more views than this, but of course this hasn't been online for very long. It was the beginning of the month that we released it, and I feel like the general consensus from people who have watched it has been one of impressed, that they are impressed with Kaz Clark's testimony. I don't think it's just you or I who believe that she's highly credible. It does seem to be the general consensus.
And is the activity, military interest in the area, is that ongoing? I think you hint about it in the film. Are there people poking around looking for things still?
Yes, it does seem that there are still reports of people seeing military poking around in the area. I think nearby Kaz's home, she says that she witnessed one night it would look like a search of a nearby field at night, and you could see in one of her videos them poking around with flashlights and, you know, looking for something, you know.
And is it also, Laura, a UFO hotspot now? Is there a lot more of activity like that?
Yes, definitely. This extends beyond Kaz, and indeed our friend who connected us to this case has seen UFOs there above Penturk. It is, as you said, a hotspot now.
Kaz Clark says she has taken 3 polygraph exams. And is that true? Do you know that to be the case?
Yes, she has all the documentation from that. That's self-funded. She went to some of the best people that she could find in the industry, using people that the government uses. She is very much of the opinion that she wants to make her case as watertight as possible, and is completely willing to undergo, as you say, 3 polygraph tests in order to prove that as best as she is able to.
Eric, I know that, as we mentioned, there are other investigators working on this. What about media interest, the general media, newspapers in the UK or in Wales? Is there any coverage that's been ongoing, or has it been largely ignored?
I would say it's been largely ignored. It's mostly reserved just for, you know, locals in the area, websites. I think, you know, it's only with our documentary right now that's starting to come out a little bit more.
We'll take a call. First-time caller, Larry in North Carolina. You're on with Laura and Eric. What's on your mind?
Oh, well, first of all, I'd like to say, how you doing, George? I'm a first-time caller. And secondly, how you doing, couple, Eric and Laura, I believe? Well,
yeah.
My question was to see about the color lights that you were seeing was green and red. And my question was, was there any other type of other lights besides that, like bright lights, you know, coming from the unknown objects?
Sorry, I just had a bit of trouble hearing that.
He's asking about any other lights beside the red and green ones. I think you had mentioned something like whitish amber that was close to the ground in the film.
Yes, the pyramid itself. So it had 3 red lights at the points of the triangle, but there were also lights along the edges. And Kaz explains that as it got closer to the ground, as it ejected that hand of lightning, But the lights changed. They went like an orangey color and then a bright white color. So, yeah, there were some different colors seen that night on the various crafts.
There's no one who has any video of this or photos of any of the events, right?
Well, interestingly enough, Dave, her neighbor, then I tried to get out his phone to go to the area to try to, you know, capture video, camera, photograph. But the phone didn't work. And no matter what he did to the phone, it just would not work. And later, I think it broke altogether, actually, after this night. It is theorized that the E3 Sentry has electronic jamming capabilities and that it might have knocked out, phones and cameras in the area.
You know, sometimes in these UFO cases, as you two probably know better than I do, there are seemingly unrelated paranormal events that pop up. I know you are both familiar with those kinds of incidents because you have a wide depth of experience in these areas. Is there anything like that in the area around Penturk that's popped up?
Beyond the things that you would expect connected to a UFO sighting, not that we're aware of, but there are certainly lots of anomalies, as you mentioned before, the EMF radiation anomalies, and also perhaps less paranormal strangeness, kind of branching off the idea of the phones not working. Kaz also claims that she and her neighbor, they had their laptops hacked and their emails accessed and things like that deleted. So I think it's a mixture of paranormal strangeness, but also perhaps human strangeness as well going on there.
You think for Kaz, your witness, that there are consequences. It's been an incredibly stressful period where she's had threats. She had to be quiet. Now she's come out and has to worry about what the repercussions of that might be. Is there evidence of like PTSD?
Most certainly. I know from just meeting her very briefly, standing in the field where the incident happened, whenever a plane would fly overhead as we were talking, her eyes immediately went to the sky. After seeing what she claims she saw, we can only imagine the stress that it caused, and she herself would admit that she suffered some kind of post-traumatic stress because of it.
Yeah, I remember one time she said, after looking at a plane and looking at it, oh, it's only a plane, like as though she still sort of expects something there, you know.
Well, she's very plucky. I know there are outreach efforts to try to get more witnesses to come forward. Is there a place where witnesses could go, where they could reach out to you, maintain some kind of anonymity or something if they wanted to share more information?
Yes. So if somebody did have information, they're more than welcome to go onto our website, paranormalscholar.com. We have a contact form on there. And we always pride ourselves on dealing with people in a sensitive way. We've been doing this for years now, and some of the videos that we post do include people's personal experiences where I narrate them on our YouTube channel. And if someone wants to remain anonymous, that's completely their right. And we understand how difficult it is to have an experience of something that you can't explain and knowing what to do with it. Yeah.
Well, the site is tremendously interesting. I can't wait to dive into it more. Eric, you were drawn to this because of an NDE at a young age. What happened?
Well, I was 8 years old. I caught a cold, a really bad cold, and my temperature went up roughly, I told the time, like 104, something like that. Quite high, you know, dangerously high. And at this point, I had an out-of-body experience. And, you know, as a kid, I would say that was a very profound moment in my life where things sort of changed. I started looking at the world in a different way. During this out-of-body experience, it was almost, it was quite spiritual, let's say. Something spoke to me, not in a way like with words, and it sounds bizarre, but it kind of with feeling. And it asked me at a very young age, I still remember to this day, do you want to die? Now, you know, then it showed me some things I can't really remember, and ultimately I said, no, I want to live, and I went back into my body, and after this bizarre experience, I've always been like, what happened? Yeah. What has happened that night? There's a bit more to this world than at first glance.
Laura, same kind of question for you. You've had an interest in this for a long time. Was there an incident that triggered it?
Yeah, so I've had an interest for a long time and didn't necessarily experience anything as profound as Eric, it was always something that I dabbled in, but through our work that we did on our documentary a couple of years ago, In Search of the Dead, quite a lot of personal stuff came out in that that linked back to my childhood that I was unaware of at the time. And yeah, it is all rather complicated, but it really does boil down to the fact that even if you think that you're skeptical and removed as an observer, which we always try and say we are, there are moments that will surprise you and will shake your world personally once you start looking into this.
Yep. And is that what drew the two of you together, is your mutual interest in weird stuff?
Yeah, it was something that we kind of discovered afterwards as a coincidence of a passion that we both had, and then a natural development from there was
we started going on ghost tours at the beginning.
Yeah.
Places, and it kind of developed from there really into something more serious, you know.
Yeah, and that's how the Paranormal Scholar came to be.
So tell me about the site. It has just a lot of content on it that I can't wait to see, and I joined up today. So what you wanted to do with it and how it works out. Laura, you can start, and then Eric.
Yes, so the Paranormal Scholar is essentially, we like to try and synthesize cases and present them in a way that is comprehensive and accessible to people, because we find that there's two ends of the spectrum when it comes to the paranormal, that you do have academic research being done, but it's so inaccessible to the public. And then on the other end, you have cases that are presented that are ridiculed. And because it's not, there is not really mainstream belief in the paranormal, that these cases are perhaps not as well presented as they should be. So that's why we call ourselves a scholar. We're a student of the strange, in a way. And we hope to present paranormal cases in a way that people can access, and it maybe makes them stop and think, maybe there is something to this.
And Eric, same sort of question for you. It must be really satisfying work, and you're in search of a larger audience. Obviously, you want to keep going, but you have to walk a line as journalists, right?
Yes, definitely. But I would say, you know, it's sort of a thrill in the chase also in every single case, the idea that you want to pursue the truth behind every single thing. I always feel like once I get my teeth sunk into something, I feel like I can't let go. I got to just keep going and going and going until I find all this. Same thing with this Pentec incident we did. You know, it was kind of like a rabbit hole. Once we started, we just couldn't stop. And you know, we love that about the paranormal, the fact that, you know, a lot of cases out there get so deep. And, you know, it's a great chase, a great investigation, really.
Do you anticipate doing another film on it, Laura, assuming that other witnesses come forward? Are there threads get unraveled?
Oh, definitely. This case has a lot of potential for follow-up. The investigation is not over. There are still freedom of information requests pending. And as you say, the request for more witnesses to come forward, if more people did come forward and share what they saw that night, we could get more pieces of the puzzle that we really need to understand what happened.
I imagine there is pushback on this case from skeptics and debunkers. We're going to get into that in our next segment, our next and final segment, and we'll take any callers who have questions as well. And then want to discuss some of the other documentary work that is available on your site. We're talking with Laura Roughton and Eric Roughton, filmmakers, about the Pentec incident, as well as other projects that they've worked on their site, The Paranormal Scholar. We have some open lines if you want to give us a call. Otherwise, I'll move on and to other subjects as well. Our final segment of Coast to Coast is coming up. Laura, the British Roswell, that's what the Bentwaters case has always been labeled. Mm-hmm. I think your case might be a better example of a British Roswell, if there is such a thing. Are there any similar cases that you know of, or anything close to the Pentec incident?
Well, I think what's interesting about this case is the size and shape of the main craft that was seen. It really is hard to describe just how open those fields are in Pentec and how unimaginably massive the craft would have been. And because of that, this case does stand out as quite unique. You mentioned, of course, the famous Rendlesham Forest incident, and it was claimed that there was a triangular craft there, but that was only 2 to 3 meters across, according to eyewitnesses. So this it seems to be in a league of its own in that respect.
Well, your UFO in this case is not only triangular, it's pyramid-shaped, I think you described it, which, you know, we recently had some video that Jeremy Corbell released here of some pyramid activity over a U.S. warship. So just so the pyramid word jumped out at me. Eric, is there a pushback from skeptics and debunkers in the U.K., or have American debunkers latched onto this yet?
Well, I think that is always skeptics, really, in any case. And, of course, they are dismissive of it. I mean, it's good to be skeptical, of course. It challenges investigators to get a more watertight case. You know, I think they poke holes, perhaps, that Kaz is the star witness, of course. And it's just very convenient that the phones were jammed. They just say there's just not enough evidence, basically.
We'll switch to some other subjects on the Paranormal Scholar. Laura, you focused on In Search of the Dead. So what is that one?
So In Search of the Dead was it's our biggest project that we've ever undertaken. It's a two-hour documentary on life after death, which we released in 2019. And our intention with that was just to ask the question, what happens after we die, you know? A very small and modest question as it is, but to look at it from a completely unbiased perspective. To get as many different perspectives from other people as possible. And doing that, we interviewed all manner of people, leading academics in the UK, paranormal investigators, mediums, both psychic and physical, authors. And we went to several different locations as well, including Romania, where we did an investigation in what is said to be the most haunted forest in the world. It really was quite an ambitious project, and we got some interesting findings.
Well, there's a resurgence of interest in this subject here. Leslie Kane had written a book about surviving death, and the Bigelow Institute here, Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies here in my hometown, Las Vegas, is this worldwide contest that is designed to sort of seek out pockets of academic research around the world. And turns out there's a lot of them. They don't communicate with the public all that much. They are worried about blowback, I suspect, but there are a lot of really serious, smart people who are looking into this.
Yes, that's definitely the case. I know there's one, Professor Chris Rowe. He was in our documentary, and he's very prestigious. He's been studying this for years, absolutely for years. And there are other professors, Dr. David Luke, Dr. Matthew Smith, other academics just here in the UK, many others in America. But like you said, there's a lack of connectivity, there's a lack of, peer reviewing almost. But yes, there's a huge underground movement almost to find out more about survival and life after death.
And the subject matter has been, it's a black mark because of fakes over the centuries of people who claim to be mediums who have no abilities, who try to separate people from their money. I'm sure you must have touched on that at some point.
Yeah, definitely. I would say that there have been people that have given it a bad name, but, people shouldn't dismiss the whole subject just because of a few bad eggs. When medicine has had many quacks in the past, we don't dismiss all the advances of medicine. I think it's still in its early days, the study of survival, and I think it definitely needs more attention.
Laura, the UK was once sort of a center for this kind of research a century or so ago. Some of the leading minds of that era were in the whole world were interested in these subjects and pursued them with vigor. Can you tell me about the ghost research in your country now, whether there are academics who are involved in that sort of thing, and whether your films have focused on that particular aspect of survival of consciousness?
Yes, so you're right to point out, of course, that there was at least a more public awareness of research into this in the past, but I don't think that it has gone away. Organizations like the Society for Psychical Research are still there. They are still active, and as Eric pointed out, academics like Professor Chris Rowe work heavily with mediums in order to observe brainwave patterns and different states of consciousness in order to find out what is consciousness. Is it possible for consciousness to survive physical death, or for us to indeed communicate with consciousness after death? So I think it is definitely there, but there is a wariness of this information coming out into the public, and that kind of contamination, I guess you could say, with the fraudulent cases. It's very difficult to know what to do with this information, but I think it certainly is still being researched.
Eric, those of us here in the U.S. think of the U.K., Ireland, and Wales, and Britain as every building in the whole place is haunted because so many of them are old. Have you had cameras in old haunted buildings, or supposedly haunted, where you see a materialization or something show up?
Well, we haven't been that fortunate to catch a materialization, but I think if you ask the average British person, they will say that every building is indeed haunted in the U.K.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
You do have a spirit child, Rosalie, a materialization that you made a documentary about on your site. Can you share that story?
Yes, that's a fascinating story. It goes back to sort of a century ago. One of the great investigators, Harry Price, he was one of the ones that debunked a lot of fraudulent cases, and was known as a sort of like arch unmasker of false mediums. So he investigated this case. He was invited one night to come to a kind of a home circle to see where they would guarantee a ghost, with the word they used. So he was intrigued, so he went there one night. And what happened was something that has perplexed him to this day, because it wasn't like many mediumistic circles have a lot of theater to them. This case didn't have any of that. It was very emotional. What it was the mother apparently was there present of a child who had died many years before, and she had been starting to see her come to her bed every single night. And they formed this home circle in order to communicate with her more properly. And they sort of didn't really consider it sort of like a mediumistic circle, but rather a sacred communion between mother and daughter. And they invited Harry Price to witness this one night, and what he saw was, you know, a young girl materialize, and really, you know, a very emotional scene, everyone crying. The mother was very much convinced that she was looking at her child, and he was, you know, he was convinced that she wasn't acting, And, you know, such a case like that, where you don't have the theater of it and it's very emotional, does trigger one to think. Unfortunately, he couldn't really pursue more of the case because this happened in he investigated in 1937, and by the time he tried to arrange something, World War II broke out, and he died a few years after World War II, so, you know, the 40s were very turbulent. But it has remained a mystery ever since, what happened on that night.
Laura, how often do you put up new content on the Paranormal Scholar site?
So on our YouTube channel, we put up a new video every 2 weeks, and then on our website, it's it could be more frequently or less frequently than that. But we're always active and always looking for people who have interesting stories to get those cases out there.
Well, it's a broad reach. I mean, Men in Black, ghosts, evil creatures, Ouija board, a lot of stuff there. We can talk about that. I'm going to go to the phone lines first, then we'll come back to it. First-time caller, Alan in Georgia. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning.
What's on your mind? I think Alan is gone. We'll go to the East Line, Doug in New Jersey. Hello, Doug.
Good evening. How are you all tonight?
We're good. What's on your mind?
I'm glad to hear that. Yes, I was curious as to what propels them to either check out a case, be it in the United States or the UK. Do they research this before they go ahead and check these places out, or is it more or less by word of mouth or through other paranormal people and things like that?
So I would say we have different methods of choosing cases. So some of it is that we do our own research beforehand, especially in historic cases. That's much more home-based book research, online research. But definitely we hear cases through other people, and when we're able to, going out there on locations such as with the Penn Turk incident really is the preferable way to investigate. You will never get as good a look at a case as you will from the mouth of somebody who claims to have experienced something.
Thanks for the call. We're going to the international line. Shane in Melbourne. Hey, Shane, how you doing? Welcome to the Coast to Coast program. What's on your mind?
Yeah, g'day, George. I love your program, mate. It's a very, very important subject we're talking about. I think that there is something manipulating, I believe, the human species. I've been looking at the behaviour within Australia of just our evolution, and it just doesn't make sense, you know, in a lot of different areas. But there was a brilliant incident you would have heard about. I think you covered it, that the Westall incident in Melbourne. It was a suburb just outside of Melbourne in 1966, and some students came out for lunch, and two of them came very close to this object, but it was a craft that landed in the fields behind that school. The two children who actually experienced it, one of them who went close to the craft, was actually, after the incident, whizzed off with the family being taken out of the home, and it was just totally covered up. And I'm a pretty good researcher in certain areas within the Australian culture, and I only found out about it a couple of years ago. It was so covered up. Army came, the Air Force actually came to look at these craft, and I believe it's probably one of the greatest signs that we are being definitely, I believe, manipulated by a species. I look at different aspects of generational conditioning, and I won't go too much into it. I'll probably get hung up on, but I love the work you guys do, and keep on to it, because we need the evidence. You know, the general population, I think, are being blindsided by this, and we really need for, the future generations not to be manipulated maybe by a species that is manipulating us, not for the betterment of the human race.
Well, thanks for calling in from Melbourne, Shane. There's a friend of mine down there who runs a site called the Oz Files, who has investigated that Westall incident. It's pretty famous. Laura and Eric, have you ever done any work on that?
Yes, we have, and it is phenomenal in the sense that it is a mass sighting, and it is always interesting when you have multiple witnesses saying the same thing. And I know that the school where that happened, I believe they have a mural, or until recently they potentially did have a mural on the school of a UFO. It is so ingrained now in the culture of that area that something happened. And it doesn't matter how much the case is suppressed or covered up, you can't change what people believe that they saw.
I will try to get one more call in on the wild card line. Ed in Tehachapi. Hey, Ed, welcome to Coast to Coast.
You rattle off that town Tehachapi pretty easily, George. I wanted to ask your guest, I apologize if I missed the comment, but I was wondering if among the other people you talked to about this incident, did you bring any mediums or psychics into the area to see if they picked up anything?
Yes, there has been at least one medium who has gone to the site. In fact, I think there was a couple, and they have reported sensitivity to the area, particularly the bald patch where that hand of lightning was said to have touched down. And it's not just mediums as well. In the 18 months or 2 years or so after the incident, people would go in there and they would report strange sensations, changes perhaps to how healthy they felt, that they would get headaches, that they wouldn't feel very well. So it's not just people with that heightened sensitivity, the mediums, but ordinary people as well have claimed to have been affected physically by where this event took place.
Thanks, Ed. Appreciate it. So are there, you mentioned about radiation. Are there other sensors that have been used that indicate something is odd or has changed in that section where the thing crashed or where it was seen?
Vegetation has been affected. It continues to struggle to grow there even 5 years later. But yes, a lot of work by local UFO researchers has been done to kind of plot different electromagnetic field readings and seem to indicate that you can actually follow through the field the path that the pyramid craft took based on the footprint, if you like, of disturbances to the electromagnetic field there. And that was detectable 18 months after the incident.
Laura Roten and Eric Roten, thanks for joining us. It was a fascinating conversation. One suggestion, maybe a public records request, a FOIA request to the U.S. Department of Defense, see if they have any records that relate to this thing.
Yeah.
Best of Thank you both for being here. Best of luck. I recommend that people check out the Paranormal Scholar. A lot of great work there, and hope we talk to you again.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.
So Laura and Eric, Paranormal Scholar, we have a link on our website. Thanks also to my earlier guest, Donna Frankart, I've Seen Dead People, and to my colleagues there, my main man, Michael Cosio, Donna Walker, always there to help me get through these programs, Ryan Stacey, our webmaster, Dan Galante and Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. I'm back next Saturday and Sunday. Hope you can tune in then. Good night.